This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing George Werthner. He's an outdoorsman, an author, photographer, writer, and he sits on the boards of several environmental and wildlife organizations. He just completed an adventurous trip on the Ivishak River on the north slope of Alaska. So, welcome, George. We're interested in hearing about your adventure.
Yeah, I'm glad to be chatting with you about it, Jay.
Okay, so George, what prompted your trip up to the far north of Alaska?
Well, a couple of things. I've always been in love with the Brooks Range since the first time I was up there back in, I think in 1973 was the first time. And then I worked as a backcountry ranger in the Gates of the Arctic National Park. And I've made other multiple trips, you know, without working for somebody like the BLM or the Park Service to the Brooks Range as well. And it may sound kind of a little odd, but I wanted both of my kids to experience the Brooks Range. And, oh, a number of years ago, I was able to get up there with my daughter for a couple of week-long backpack trip in the Gates of the Arctic.
Uh-huh.
And but my son was unable to go on that trip. So this trip came about partly in response to that I wanted to get him up there to see the Brooks Range. And last year, I floated a big section of the Kobuk River on the western edge of the Brooks Range with a friend from Shoto, Montana, Bill Cunningham, who has been very active early on in protecting wilderness in Montana. For example, he drew the boundaries for the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness and was involved in getting the Lee Metcalf Wilderness and other early wilderness efforts in Montana accomplished. So anyway, after our trip last year in the Kobuk, Bill said, well, let's do another trip next summer. So we started looking at options, and that's how this all came about.
So it was just the two of you?
On the Kobuk, on this trip, there was my son, Bill Cunningham from Shoto, and another old college buddy of mine, Scott Kronberg, who lives in Bismarck, North Dakota.
Uh-huh. And was there anything in particular that you wanted to find out on this trip?
Well, not really, but the trip was entirely north of the Arctic Divide, which means there were no trees to speak of, although we did see a few tiny patches of balsam poplar, which I don't know how long they've been on this river, but in the Gates of the Arctic, where I went with my daughter, I hiked over a portion of the Gates of the Arctic that I had done a backpack trip in 1975 or 74, somewhere in there with some buddies before it was a national park. And at that time, there was no balsam poplar in the area that we had hiked through then, and I found some small patches. So it's an example of the advancement of the trees in the North Country due to climate warming.
So how did you get up there?
Well, it's a little complicated, but I'll go through the story because it's kind of interesting. We flew from Fairbanks, or I should say Scott and Bill flew in a Cessna from Fairbanks all the way to the headwaters of the river, which, by the way, the largest land, there aren't very many named landmarks around there, but there is a lake called Porcupine Lake, which we did not land on, but it just downstream from Porcupine Lake. You can see where Porcupine Lake is on a map, in the western part of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. So this was to the east of the Gates of the Arctic National Park. Mm-hmm. And so Bill and Scott flew in all the way to the river's headwaters. Meanwhile, my son and I took a commercial flight to the village, Arctic Village, which is right up on the southern boundary of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And I had done a backpack trip out of that spot back in 1975. I had tried to cross the Brooks Range alone I won't go into all the details, but, you know, I made it up to the Arctic Divide and then turned around. But so I hadn't been back to Arctic Village since that time, which was kind of nice to go to. And the bush pilot then flew from where he dropped Bill and Scott off to Arctic Village, which was much shorter than going all the way back to Fairbanks. So it saved us some money, picked us up in Arctic Village and dropped us off at the same place. And that was the beginning of our trip.
So you you headed into a headwaters point on the on the south end of the river?
Yes. Yeah. Just a little bit below this major feature, Porcupine Lake.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of the, you know, there's limited places you can land a bush plane, and the place that our pilot was familiar with, he was able to land on dry tundra, which was, really, you know, he has these big balloon tires, and it was interesting to see. After he took off, you couldn't even tell that a plane had landed there. So he dropped us off, and as luck would have it, it started to rain not long after that, and the rivers around there will flood very rapidly because most of the area is underlain by permafrost. So when it rains, it can't soak into the ground. It just goes all in the river. So when we first landed there, the river was low and clear, and we were worried about getting hung up on gravel bars. And then it rained for the next 2 days, and then we were worried about, you know, it was too much water and dangerous to go on. But that's the way it is up there.
So in relation to in relation to Point Barrow, where Will Rogers and Wiley Post were killed, where were you for in relationship to Point Barrow?
Well, if you would go east, you would hit Prudhoe Bay, where all the oil activity and the Pipeline Haul Road begins or ends, depending upon how you want to call it. We were just a little bit to the east of Prudhoe Bay. And in fact, at the end of the trip, our river gets very close to the Pipeline Haul Road. And so what we did is we had arranged, there's a shuttle van that goes from Prudhoe Bay to Fairbanks. So rather than fly back to Fairbanks, we had arranged for this shuttle to pick us up on the Pipeline Haul Road. And it's funny because there's a 15-minute window. In other words, the van would only wait 15 minutes if you weren't there. Goodbye van, and it only goes twice a week. So we were a little concerned about getting there, but we were able to carry all our gear from the river to the road, and then I don't know, we were maybe 30 or 40 miles from the Arctic Ocean at that time, and then ride back to Fairbanks.
So the source of the river is at Porcupine Lake?
That's one source, yeah, and then there's another branch that goes to the west. So there's the two major branches join right there below Porcupine Lake, and that's basically where we started our trip from.
And you had kayaks, what, inflatable kayaks, or what were they?
Yeah, we had what are called pack rafts, and the pack rafts are part of the reason for taking pack rafts is you pay for every single pound that you take on a bush plane over and above a certain limit. And so weight became a real consideration for us in terms of trying to keep the costs down.
Yeah.
And so these pack rafts work really well. I mean, they work better than I had only used them a little bit on some of the rivers around, you know, the west, but never a long trip or anything. And they operated really well in general. So I was, in other words, they went over rocks and stuff and didn't seem to get tears in them and things like that. So I was really pleased, which, of course, when you're in such a remote location, any kind of thing like a hole and something like that can really mess you up.
All right.
In terms of getting back out of the mountains.
So I hear you had a little accident.
Yep.
Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I mentioned that after we landed, we spent 2 days sitting in a tent, not doing anything, waiting for the rain to stop. And when the rain stopped, the river had come up many, many feet.
Mm.
And so it was racing along, you know, it was real muddy, went from clear to real muddy. So you couldn't see things like rocks or anything like that very easily. And the whole river all the way out to the Arctic Ocean was just like small gravel and small rocks, no big boulders. So there was, it was just really fast, continuously fast. And there are very few places to pull out, you know, like eddy out like you would on a river around here, because there's no trees in there, there's no boulders, and so forth. So anyway, with the river in flood, we were concerned about making connection with that van back to Fairbanks. And we had no idea really how long it would take us to float the river. So we took off while the river was still in flood and hadn't gone probably more than a mile. And the wind was blowing up the river. And of course the river is pushing down very fast. And one of the things about the pack rafts, just like a regular raft, is they're hard to maneuver in high winds. And I was going along downstream and this gust of wind came and turned my, pack raft to the sideways. And that's all it took. I was over and flipped in a second. And I'd never flipped in a canoe or a kayak or anything. So it was a, it was kind of like this, shock, like, I can't believe I just flipped. And so I swam the shore, and fortunately my son Stratton was downstream and he saw me flip and he was able to catch the kayak before it floated all the way to the Arctic Ocean.
Mm.
And I'm only exaggerating a little bit there because the river is so braided, as I mentioned. The raft would have, well, we were right at a big bend in the river. If it had gone around the bend, with would have been no telling which of maybe a, you know, a dozen channels it was floating down. So finding it again could be real problematic. And these pack rafts are not very big. In other words, I wouldn't be able to sit in my son's pack raft and go out. There's just no space.
Mm-hmm.
And then plus my pack raft had some of the group food. I had the tent for my son and I and some other stuff that, again, had we not captured the raft, it could have been bad. And the other thing that was kind of funny, you know, this is what you do when you don't think about stuff. So I swam all the way to shore, and I never let go of my paddle, which was another good thing, because even if we'd gotten the raft and I had lost the paddle, we would have tipped multiple times anyway going down the river. I'm certain of that.
Yeah.
And then shortly, okay, adding to it, shortly after I tipped over, Scott tipped over in the same basic area. And so I had to stand around on shore while we were trying to gather up Scott's boat, and he had to repack it. He didn't lose any gear, but he had to repack it. So I was standing on the shore for about 2 hours and, you know, with frigid water and clothes. I didn't have any wetsuit or anything like that. And finally I said to my son, hey, we got to take off and get a campsite because I got to get in dry clothes, which as we got to a campsite and unloaded my kayak, we discovered that I had not sealed the dry bag sufficiently. So my sleeping bag was dry, but just about everything else was wet. So I had to climb in my sleeping bag in a wet down jacket with wet, you know, pants on and so forth, and over the course of the night it all dried out, but that was stopped from, I was really shivering a lot. I was on the verge of hypothermia, so and I had this whole hypothermia thing in mind in particular because I had worked for Doug Tompkins, who had created a bunch of national parks in South America, who died a number of years ago kayaking down in Patagonia also from hypothermia. So I'm like, in the back of my mind, I'm like, you know, this could end not so good if I don't get warm soon. So anyway, that's what happened. And after that, I repacked my pack raft to put the center of gravity down lower, and I sat as low as I could in it, and I didn't have any further issues after that.
What was the air temperature when you got out of the river?
Well, it had been pretty cold. It had been a cold rain. In fact, the next day it snowed on us. So I don't know. It was probably in the 40s. And but you know, standing around with all my clothes were wet, and that was the main thing. I had to wait around. I couldn't get into my. See, the thing was, even though my son had captured the raft, there was no place to camp right there. And camping selection along the river, you know, you're not restricted by permits or anything. But as I mentioned, the river is so fast and has very few eddies and stuff. Finding a place where the river slowed down enough where you could pull out onto a beach and unload your gear was somewhat problematic.
Did you have any trouble swimming out after you spilled, swimming out of the river?
Didn't even think about it. at the shoreline, you know, well, there's another little bit of information I had to say. I went on this trip. I've been suffering for a number of months now with a really bad case of sciatica. I could hardly walk without crutches.
Right.
And we had planned this trip a long time ago, and I debated the whole time, should I go, should I not? But one of the things I found is I could sit in a kayak, and it didn't hurt to paddle, but it sure hurt to walk.
Yeah.
And I found out I could swim really good when I had to with sciatica.
Yeah, yeah. So was the water temperature near freezing in the 30s?
Yeah, it was probably, I didn't take the temperature, but it was very cold, of course, you know, near the headwaters. It's coming out of springs and streams. In fact, after we camped that night and the next morning, we had fresh snow on all the mountains, so it got pretty cold at night, and the snow eventually melted away, but it lasted a few days on the mountains. So, on the other hand, and this is the really interesting thing, by the time we got out on the coastal plain towards the Arctic Ocean, we had 2 days where the temperature got up to 80 degrees, and we were almost too hot. You know, I mean, it was like you kept putting your hand in the water there to cool off, and yeah, you know, mopping your head with a to get cold water on your face because it was so hot sitting in the kayak.
Yeah. So the mountains that the river flows through, are they called the Philip Smith Mountains?
Yes, the Philip Smith Mountains. And for people in Montana, they are the same geological formation that's in the Rocky Mountain front. They're limestone and from the same geological age. And a lot of times, I mean, you look like you're in the Rocky Mountain front, except for, of course, the absence of trees. And one of the really fun things about doing this trip, and I did another trip on the Canning River, which is the next major drainage to the east of this river in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. I did a kayak trip there years ago. But when you get out on the coastal plain, you're looking back at this line of mountains. You can see it. You know, the Birch Range is about 600-700 miles long.
Uh-huh.
And when you get out on the coastal plain, you might be able to see, you know, 100 to 200 miles of the mountains. And you're out there on the coastal plain, and it looks like just like being on the plains of Montana, say in Shodo or Great Falls, looking at the Rocky Mountain front, except there's no fences, there's no ranches, there's no,
yeah, right,
there's no, no, hardly infrastructure at all that indicates that, you know, humans have been there. We did pass one camp lodge-like thing of tents that a hunting guide had set up just outside of the mountains, you know, that during hunting season apparently gets used. But there's really not a lot there. And another thing that's kind of neat is if you look at a topo map of the area, other than things like Porcupine Lake, there's hardly any names on the map at all. And you know, whenever we camp, my son, he's real active. He climbed there almost every day. He tried to climb a peak or two. And, you know, he's getting up there and he's looking in all directions around taking pictures. And there's not a named feature anywhere in the picture except for the river we're on.
Mm. So
that's pretty cool.
The Philip Smith Mountains are a subset of the Brooks Range. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of subset names. Like if you start over in the western part where the Kobuk is, you've got the Blard Mountains. Then you got the where the Gates of the Arctic is, that's usually called the Endicott Mountains. Then you get into the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and you have the Philip Smith Mountains, and then way over by the Yukon border, the British Mountains. And why they have different names, I can't tell you. I can tell you that the Philip Smith Mountains are named for a geologist who explored the Brooks Range around 1900 or so. So that is why that's called that. And the Brooks Range itself, the whole range, gets its name from Alfred Brooks, who was the head of the U.S. Geological Survey in Alaska around 1900s. And so some of these you can trace back to whoever was kind of the first ones to do any kind of mapping of the areas.
And what's the elevation of those mountains?
Well, you know, they get up to about 9,000 feet.
Really?
The highest peak.
Wow.
Yeah, and you're starting, you know, like you're out on the coastal plain, you're 500 feet above sea level. So that's quite a bit of rise. And, well, to go all the way to the Arctic Ocean, you're at zero, of course, feet. And I think the lowest we were at was about 500, maybe 400 feet where we were pulling out. But anyway, a lot of them have the north-facing slopes in particular still have some relic glaciers. But one of the things interesting about the whole Brooks Range in general is that it's a very dry landscape, again, sort of like the Rocky Mountain Front, because, you know, most of the moisture comes from the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea. And if it's coming from the Gulf of Alaska, which does not freeze over, the Gulf of Alaska is where Valdez is at, for example, but it has to cross, like, a whole bunch of mountain ranges. Any air mass will cross first the Chugach and the Wrangell Mountains, then it'll cross the Alaska Range, and then it goes across the Yukon River Valley and hits some smaller ranges there, like the Ray Mountains and so forth. And then finally it gets to the Brooks Range. So a lot of the moisture has been wrung out, and the winters are so cold up there, there's virtually, you know, hardly ever get much moisture in the winter. Coldfoot, which is a little town on the south side of the Brooks Range, which is along the Hall Road. In fact, we went through there. That holds the low record temperature for Alaska, coldest side. I believe it was 83 below zero straight temperature. So anyway, when it's that cold, you don't get any snow or anything. So the Brooks Range in general doesn't have a lot of glaciers on it, which is one of the attractions, because the further south you go into Alaska, you know, you get the Chugach Mountains right next to, like, where Valdez is, and they get many, many feet of snow and glaciers all over. So you really got to have special mountaineering gear and stuff to go any distance, whereas you can do fairly long treks in the Brooks Range because you don't encounter any glaciers or any permanent snowfields unless you climb a peak, of course.
So what were the daylight hours?
Well, the sun never set. I got some pictures I took at midnight, which is, you know, eventually it does, but that far north, I don't think you get sunset until sometime in September. You know, like Point Barrow, again, don't quote me on this, but I believe the sun rises like on May 12th or something like that, and then doesn't set again until sometime in September, and then, or maybe a little earlier, maybe the very end of August. But in any event, it's up all day long. So it does get low in the horizon as it sweeps across the northern part of the sky.
So what were your hours to lie down and sleep?
Well, we just kind of went by how we felt and what the weather was doing, partly. I mean, if it were, you know, like when it snowed, we didn't do much anything other than my son climbing mountains then, but mostly we hunkered down in the tents because I couldn't move because of my sciatica. And then, you know, we might start out floating in the afternoon and float until 8 or 9 or 10 at night, and didn't matter. And then, you know, stop for the evening, and my son might go fishing or he might climb a peak, and he might not get back to the tent till, you know, midnight or something, but it didn't matter because he had light the whole time.
Getting back to the river, did you have to climb down to the river from where you camped, or is it
It depended, and here's another thing you have to do when you're on these northern rivers. You know, I worked as a river ranger in Alaska, too, when I was younger, and so I floated a bunch of sections of wild scenic rivers that the BLM managed. And as I mentioned, when you have rain, the river can go up a lot. On the river I was, one of the rivers I was a river ranger on, we had a standard practice to bring our canoes at least up 10 feet from the water and tie it to trees, too, because you could get, if you got a whole lot of rain, you could have the river rise 5, 6, 7 feet in just a few days. So as a result, it was really important to try to get campsites that had some elevation to them. I had I mentioned I was on the Canning River a number of years ago, and with my former wife Molly, and we were camped right next to the river. And during the night, I kind of woke up. I kind of heard like water noise. And I look out of the tent, and the river was just, you know, a couple of feet away from our tent at that point. It had been raining for a couple of days. And so we had camped on a gravel bar, but it turned out that that gravel bar was no longer just a part of the main shoreline. It was now an island. So we had to get up in the, you know, it was the middle of the night, but of course it was light. but carry all our gear across this new channel to get to higher ground to camp. So on this trip, I was really, you know, pretty persnickety about having a campsite that had some elevation. I didn't like camping on the gravel bars because I didn't want to wake up in the middle of the night having to try to, you know, move everything to some higher ground. But that meant finding a place where you could pull out of the river, where it wasn't going so fast, where there was higher ground, you know, right and back. You could still camp on a gravel bar, but I didn't want to be more than, you know, like 25 or 50 feet from a higher riverbank or camping on the higher riverbank. And so we spent some nights, you know, where we were going along, okay, let's camp. We might not find a suitable place for a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm. So how fast was the river flowing? Could you estimate what the rate was?
I think it was going 7 or 8 miles per hour, at least when it was in the higher flood stages. Because we would cover a lot. You know, we didn't, it was hard to tell how many miles you actually went. We could tell straight miles, air miles, but with all the winding around of the river, it probably was double the mileage of what we could see on maps. So
you didn't have to do much paddling. The river was just carrying you along?
Oh, no. You had to do a lot of paddling for several reasons. One, when the river's that fast, the only way you have control over your craft is either go slower than the current or faster than the current. So when there was any tricky spot, like trying to get across from one channel to another before it, you know, split, you had to paddle like mad to get there faster than the current was pushing you, or you'd get pushed up on a gravel bar, and then that was kind of a pain because you had to jump out and drag the boat and try to get back in before the raft took off for the Arctic Ocean. Mm-hmm. And the other reason why is that these channels would braid and braid sometimes, so you'd be on what you thought was the main channel because the most of the water was going down it, but then it could braid two or three times, and pretty soon your channel that had most of the water now has hardly any water. And so you sometimes have to paddle really fast to get over like low spots as you hit on the bottom of the boat trying to get downstream. And if that didn't work, you had to jump out and drag your boat then.
Well, George, we're just about out of time, but I have more questions to ask and like to know about wildlife. So we'll do part two. So
okay.
This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com. You can see our website at js-wilderness.com. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.